Kanye in Washington, wishing you all a very good morning.
Today is Monday, January 17th, and this is VOA's International Edition. I am Chinedu Afo in Washington. Coming up in the next half hour, the U.S. marks Martin Luther King Jr. Day, but the fight for social justice continues to play a central role in politics.
I have a dream. My four little children will one day live in a nation where they will not be judged by the color of their skin, but by the content of their character.
The U.S. and its allies say they are, quote, ready for any contingency, unquote, with Moscow, as Ukraine suffers a massive cyber attack.
The White House also confirmed reports that the U.S. has intelligence that Russia is already preparing a so-called false flag operation.
And the World Food Program warns Ethiopia is on the verge of disaster as fighting prevents the delivery of food to millions. We'll have these stories and more next on International Edition. Stay tuned. The United States observes Martin Luther King Jr. Day Monday, recognizing the Black American pastor internationally known as a symbol for civil rights. Lauren Bowman reports on how social justice issues continue to play a central role in U.S. politics.
Today I want to say to the people of America and the nations of the world, we're on the move and no wave of racism can stop us.
Martin Luther King Jr.'s rise as a civil rights leader began in 1955 when he spearheaded the drive to desegregate public buses in the southern state of Alabama. He went on to lead peaceful national movements pushing for equal rights. In 1964, King won the Nobel Peace Prize, and that same year, U.S. President Lyndon Johnson signed the Civil Rights Act, and the following year, the Voting Rights Act. The measures outlawed racial segregation in public places and discriminatory practices that kept blacks from voting.
I have a dream. My four little children will one day live in a nation where they will not be judged by the color of their skin, but by the content of their character.
This week, the U.S. Justice Department paid tribute to King in a virtual forum. Kristen Clark is the Assistant Attorney General for Civil Rights at the U.S. Department of Justice.
Dr. King has had a tremendous impact on all our lives, and his legacy of hope and his fierce commitment to justice and equality remain present in our day-to-day work at the Civil Rights Division.
Many civil rights leaders say King's struggle to secure equal voting rights remains painfully relevant today. Sherilyn Eiffel is the president of the NAACP Legal Defense and Education Fund.
Dr. King is saying, give us the ballot so that we can elect judges who will be just. Give us the ballot so that we can elect representatives who will carry our voice forward. Give us the ballot so that we can elect people who will understand what a criminal justice system is supposed to be.
Earlier this week, President Joe Biden and Vice President Kamala Harris paid their respects at the burial place of Martin Luther King Jr. in the U.S. state of Georgia, where Biden spoke about the ongoing national debate over voting rights.
It's not just here in Georgia. Last year alone, 19 states not proposed but enacted 34 laws attacking voting rights. There were nearly 400 additional bills Republican members of state legislatures tried to pass. It's no longer about who gets to vote. It's about making it harder to vote. It's about who gets to count the vote and whether your vote counts at all.
Republicans reject Biden's criticisms, saying they seek to safeguard, not constrain, voting in America. They also say they are alarmed over proposals to change Senate rules to pass a new national voting rights law without Republican support. Meantime, statues across the country that many associate with historical racism are coming down, such as this one of the Confederate General Thomas Stonewall Jackson. Michelle Colbert watched the statue being removed that day.
That these symbols are bad for the community. And today, we've removed that hate, and now healing can happen.
And I've seen the promised land.
was assassinated in 1968. But decades later, his famous words still inspire many to keep working for racial justice, an issue that remains a central part of America's national dialogue. Laurel Berman, VOA News, Washington.
A career CIA official has been named to oversee the intelligence community's response to possible election threats by Russia, China, and others. Associated Press correspondent Tim McGuire reports.
Jeffrey Wichman is named election threat executive by National Intelligence Director Avril Haines after efforts to put together the permanent Foreign Malign Influence Center stalled over its size and budget. Wichman will oversee all election security efforts across the 18-member intelligence community, including agencies that fight cyber attacks, disinformation campaigns, and efforts to influence politicians and policy debates. The last person to hold the job, Shelby Pearson, drew the ire of then-President Donald Trump when he told lawmakers in a private briefing that Russia's efforts to interfere in the 2020 election favored Trump. Tim McGuire, Washington.
A flurry of security talks in Europe last week aimed at defusing the crisis over Russian troops massed at the border with Ukraine have ended with no breakthrough. U.S. National Security Advisor Jake Sullivan says Washington and his allies are now, quote, ready for any contingency, unquote, to deal with Moscow's actions as Ukraine suffered a massive cyber attack on government websites. VOA senior diplomatic correspondent Cindy Sain reports.
A sweeping cyber attack briefly took down Ukraine's foreign ministry website and other government websites Friday, displaying a warning to Ukrainians. All information about you has become public. Be afraid and expect the worst. The White House says it has been briefed by Ukraine and is supporting Kyiv, but has yet to identify a culprit. Analysts say the cyber attack appears consistent with others committed by Russian actors at times of heightened tensions with Russia's neighbors and may be meant to intimidate. The White House also confirmed reports that the U.S. has intelligence that Russia is already preparing a so-called false flag operation, an attack against its own proxy forces in eastern Ukraine in order to justify another invasion of the country. White House Press Secretary Jen Psaki.
We have information that indicates Russia has already pre-positioned a group of operatives to conduct a false flag operation in eastern Ukraine. The operatives are trained in urban warfare and in using explosives to carry out acts of sabotage against Russia's own proxy forces.
Talks this week aimed at defusing the border crisis did not produce a breakthrough. And Russia's defense ministry Friday released video showing Russian tanks and infantry carrying out firing drills near the city of Rostov-on-Don in southern Russia near Ukraine. On Thursday, U.S. National Security Advisor Jake Sullivan sounded a resolute tone after the flurry of talks ended without a breakthrough.
The United States and our allies and partners are prepared for any contingency, any eventuality. We're prepared to keep moving forward down the diplomatic path in good faith, and we're prepared to respond if Russia acts. And beyond that, all we can do is get ready, and we are ready.
Russia says it did not hear any adequate answer to its demands that NATO promised to never admit Ukraine or any other former Soviet republics as new members. Michael Kimmage is with the German Marshall Fund.
It's not just diplomacy on the one hand and an outright war on the other. There are a lot of in-between scenarios as well. In some ways, the cyber attacks point us in that direction. So it's probably a dozen scenarios that the White House should be looking at, and I'm sure that they're taking a careful look at all of them.
Meanwhile, Senate Democrats have introduced legislation that would impose sanctions on top Russian officials and Russia's banking sector if Moscow invades Ukraine, as Democratic Senator Ben Cardin told VOA.
So this is a clear indication of congressional support for the strongest possible sanctions, including personal sanctions on the president of Russia, if in fact he further violates the sovereignty of Ukraine.
Senate Democrats say another Russian invasion of Ukraine would trigger war crimes and widespread human rights violations. Cindy Sain, VOA News.
The U.S. Centers for Disease Control and Prevention on Friday reversed its guidelines for Americans on wearing masks to protect against COVID-19. CDC officials are recommending donning, quote, the most protective mask you can, unquote, while stopping short of advocating nationwide usage of N95 respirators. Emma Jelly of Reuters has more.
The U.S. Centers for Disease Control and Prevention have revised their guidance for Americans on wearing masks to protect against COVID-19, recommending wearing, quote, the most protective mask you can and that you will wear consistently. But the agency stopped short of advocating nationwide usage of N95 respirators, which filter at least 95% of airborne particles, both large and small. A surgical mask, by comparison, is designed to protect others against virus particles that are breathed out. The agency on Friday said it wants to encourage Americans to wear masks rather than push them to wear the highest grade face protection, but also explicitly said that respirators provide the best level of protection, while, quote, loosely woven cloth products provide the least protection. N95 masks are flying off the conveyor belt at Protective Health Gear in Paterson, New Jersey, as the manufacturer ramps up production amidst the Omicron surge of the coronavirus in the U.S. The company's CEO, Brian Wolin, says demand is through the roof.
I've been saying since day one, if they could make these available to everyone on the planet, I personally believe that every problem that we had wouldn't be here at this particular time. Now, certainly, these weren't available in abundance back in 2020, but they are now.
The factory is operating 24/7 to manufacture 70,000 N95 respirators per day and plans to increase that number to 110,000 in the coming weeks as demand heats up. Critics have accused the CDC of offering shifting and confusing guidance throughout the pandemic regarding mask wearing. After announcing Thursday that the federal government plans to make high-quality masks available to Americans for free, the White House on Friday said the government will also begin shipping 500 million COVID-19 tests to Americans later this month without charge. COVID-19 infections in the U.S. are at their peak, with nearly 780,000 new infections reported each day.
That's Imad Jali of Reuters. Yemeni forces backed by the United Arab Emirates have joined coalition troops fighting the Houthi movement around the central city of Marib in a renewed push to take the energy-producing region. In the battle for Marib, the Iran-aligned Houthis have advanced on most districts, barring the main city and nearby hydrocarbon sites. Their assault dashed hopes for an imminent truce that the United Nations and the United States have struggled to engineer. U.S. Special Envoy for Yemen, Hans Grunberg, told the Security Council last week that both sides are, quote, doubling down on military options, unquote, and warned of devastating implications for civilians and immediate peace prospects. The nearly seven-year conflict, likely seen as a proxy war between Saudi Arabia and Iran, has killed tens of thousands of people, displaced millions, and pushed Yemen to the verge of famine as the economy collapsed. Saudi advisors and officials familiar with U.S. intelligence says Riyadh has imported sensitive missile technology from the Chinese military and is manufacturing its own ballistic missiles, raising new worries of a Middle East arms race. David DeRoches is an associate professor at National Defense University in Washington, D.C. Reporter Angie Omar asked him if the move could increase tensions between the U.S. and Saudi Arabia.
Well, it's not going to help, but it's also not a new thing. I mean, Saudi Arabia purchased Chinese missiles decades ago, and they've displayed them at military displays. We've known for years that Saudi has strategic missile forces. It's the one branch in Saudi military that doesn't work closely with the United States. And the Saudis have also, you know, expressed on numerous occasions their concern about the Iranian development of ballistic missiles and their frustration with the fact that the United States has not either shut down the ballistic missile program in Iran or offered them their own capacity. So I don't think it comes as a surprise to anybody, but right now, Saudi Arabia is a very complex issue for U.S. policy, and this certainly won't help how the kingdom is perceived in Washington.
The U.S. has long refused to sell ballistic missiles to Riyadh over proliferation concerns. How do you think the Biden administration would react?
I think that their reaction has been muted. It's a multilateral agreement not to sell ballistic missiles called the Missile Transfer Control Regime that is sort of an informal agreement. And it's not just, it dates from the Cold War, so it hasn't just affected sales of ballistic missiles, but also the United States government, in my opinion, overinterpreted it to preclude selling armed drones. And what we've seen is that both Saudi Arabia and the UAE have purchased Chinese armed drones that are not quite as good as what we would have sold. So you know, it may be time to look at the missile transfer control regime, particularly given that the Saudis are under active ballistic missile attack. They've intercepted over 300 missiles in the last year. And this idea that, you know, somehow we can prevent an arms race, it looks as though that horse might have left the barn.
Saudi Arabia's broader regional power struggle with Iran is likely its main motivation for developing ballistic missile technology. The Saudi government likely wants to counter Iran's considerable ballistic missile arsenal. What do you make of that?
I think that's a true statement. You know, a big part of our problems in weapons sales and security assistance with all of the Arab states is that we're kind of, on the one hand, we have this 1980s view that we can stop the proliferation of missiles, even while we've seen Hezbollah, Hamas, Iran, the Houthis, and various Iraq militias acquire viable, accurate, and long-range ballistic missile technology, mostly because of Iran. So, you know, it may be time to say, okay, you know, in this theater, the rather noble goal of preventing an arms race, all that's done is left our security partners vulnerable while our enemies have capitalized on that. Another thing that might be worth looking at is a lot of our regime for security assistance with the Arab states looks at it through the idea of a potential conflict with Israel. Now that we have actual peace between some of these states and a sort of de facto but not acknowledged peace between other countries to include Saudi Arabia and Israel, perhaps that's worthy of reexamination as well. We might be looking at an old threat, you know, a Cold War era threat, when the real threat is really Iran and its proxies. So I think the time is right for a reexamination. But politically, you know, in the wake of, you know, the unresolved, from the U.S. perspective, murder of Jamal Khashoggi and the, you know, disastrous war in Yemen, President Biden's party will not welcome any lessening of security assistance restrictions on Saudi Arabia. So I'm not sure if politically the time is right, but certainly militarily it is right to re-examine this regime.
That's David DeRoches, an associate professor at National Defense University in Washington, speaking with reporter Angie Omar in Cairo. The World Food Program warns Ethiopia is on the edge of a humanitarian disaster. This, as escalating fighting in the north is preventing the delivery of needed food from reaching millions of people in battle-scarred Tigray province. Lisa Schlein reports for VOA from Geneva.
The last time a food convoy was able to reach Tigray's capital, Mekele, was mid-December. Millions of acutely hungry people in this war-torn province have been deprived of food since then. In a blunt warning to the warring parties and international community, World Food Program spokesman Thompson Feary says his agency's humanitarian operation in northern Ethiopia is about to grind to a halt. He says intense fighting in the region is blocking the passage of fuel and food.
Stocks of nutritionally fortified food for the treatment of malnourished children and women are now exhausted, and the last of WFP cereals, pulses, and oil will be distributed this week. Because of fighting, food distributions are at an all-time low. WFP aid workers on the ground tell me that warehouses are completely empty.
Fighting erupted between Ethiopian government troops and Tigrayan forces in November 2020. Conditions have seriously deteriorated since then. The World Food Program says 9.4 million people in northern Ethiopia now require humanitarian food aid, an increase of 2.7 million from just 4 months ago. In Tigray alone, the United Nations says 5.2 million people depend on international assistance to survive. It says 400,000 people are living in famine-like conditions, and another 2 million are on the verge of famine. The WFP aims to provide food aid for 2.1 million people in Tigray and for an additional 1.1 million people in the Amhara and Afar regions. However, money is in short supply. The UN Food Agency is urgently appealing for $337 million to carry out its emergency food assistance program in northern Ethiopia over the next 6 months. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
We'll be right back. In other news, Mali's former president Ibrahim Boubacar Keita has died nearly 18 months after he was ousted in a military coup. He was 76. His death was announced Sunday in Bamako. Keita had been battling health problems in recent years. He won the historic 2013 presidential election, helped to restore democracy after a 2012 coup. But 7 years later, he was ousted by another military takeover following months of public demonstrations against his presidency. His death comes as the sprawling African nation faces a deepening political crisis. The coup leader, who ousted Keita, has no immediate plans for a return to democracy, as initially promised. For more on this story and other breaking news, visit our website at voanews.com. Remember to connect with us on social media. We are on Twitter, Facebook, and Instagram. Search for VOA Africa. You are listening to VOA's International Edition. I am Chinedu Okwa in Washington. The United Nations is allocating $150 million from its Central Emergency Response Fund to support seriously underfunded humanitarian operations in 13 countries in Africa, the Americas, Asia, and the Middle East. Lisa Schlein reports for VOA from Geneva.
Topping the list of underfunded crises are Syria, the Democratic Republic of the Congo, and Sudan. These countries will receive between $20 and $25 million each to help them implement life-saving humanitarian operations. International support for Syria has all but dissipated after more than a decade of conflict. Some 13 million refugees and internally displaced Syrians are living in a state of destitution with little recourse to basic relief. The DRC is one of the longest and most complex humanitarian crises. Millions of people are suffering from conflict, displacement, epidemics, and acute hunger. The United Nations warns the humanitarian crisis in Sudan is deepening as political instability grows and the country contends with flooding, rising food prices, and disease outbreaks. Jens Lajerke is the spokesman for the Office for the Coordination of Humanitarian Affairs. He says the distribution of funds made by Emergency Relief Coordinator Martin Griffiths is the largest ever. He says it beats last year's $135 million by $15 million.
This announcement of funding will help the prioritization of life-saving projects to respond to, for example, food security, nutrition, health, and protection needs. More detailed strategies are expected from these countries later this month.
Other recipient countries include Myanmar, where the UN is providing aid to some 3 million people suffering from conflict, COVID-19, and a failing economy. UN aid also will go to Burkina Faso, Chad, and Niger, three countries in Africa's central Sahel that are struggling with mass displacement because of armed attacks. Lajerke says these countries, as well as six others in dire straits in Africa, the Middle East, and the Americas, including Haiti and Honduras, will receive between $5 and $12 million each from the UN fund to help them tackle their emergency needs.
These allocations happen twice a year to countries selected because of their low level of funding, severity of humanitarian needs, and vulnerability. These countries have just entered a new cycle of humanitarian fundraising and program implementation on the back of underfunded appeals from last year, all below 50% covered at year's end.
Humanitarian needs are growing across the world. The United Nations says it expects at least 274 million people will need humanitarian assistance in 2022, and it will require $41 billion to assist the most vulnerable. Afghanistan is the world's largest humanitarian appeal. The UN recently launched a record $4.5 billion appeal to assist 22 million Afghans, more than half the country's population. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
Serbian tennis champion Novak Djokovic has been deported from Australia after losing his appeal to stay in the country. Australia cancelled the visa of the world's number one tennis player on health and public order grounds. From Melbourne, Phil Mercer reports.
Novak Djokovic's supporters believe he's been unfairly treated by Australia after arriving in Melbourne last week. They said his deportation was inhumane and outrageous. After the Chief Justice of the Federal Court of Australia, James Allsop, rejected Djokovic's last-ditch attempt to remain in the country.
The orders of the court are, one, the amended application be dismissed with costs, two, reasons to be published at a later date. Those are the orders of the court.
The Serbian tennis player was granted a medical waiver from Australia's COVID-19 vaccination rules by two independent health panels set up by the Victoria State Government and Australian tennis authorities. Djokovic had been infected with the virus in December. However, his visa was cancelled when he arrived at Melbourne Airport January 5 by Border Force officials, who said he'd flouted immigration rules. He was sent to an immigration detention hotel in Melbourne. His visa was reinstated by an Australian judge on Monday, but it was revoked for a second time by Immigration Minister Alex Hawke on Friday. Djokovic isn't inoculated against COVID-19, and Hawke asserted that his presence in Australia would stir anti-vaccination sentiment and cancelled his visa on health and public interest grounds. The tennis champion's lawyers insisted the government's argument was irrational and illogical. The three federal court judges unanimously disagreed, and Djokovic's appeal Sunday was dismissed. Victoria State Premier Daniel Andrews said the Australian Open will not be diminished by the Serbian player's absence.
This Grand Slam tournament, one of the big four, is much bigger than any one person. Much bigger. That's why it's a Grand Slam. That's why it's the biggest thing in tennis in the first quarter of every year.
Djokovic has won the Australian Open title nine times. Had he triumphed at this year's tournament, he would have become the most successful men's Grand Slam champion with 21 titles. Before he left Australia, he said in a statement that he was extremely disappointed with the court ruling, but he respected the decision and would cooperate with the relevant authorities in relation to my departure from the country. Phil Mercer for VOA News, Melbourne.
This is Science in a Minute.
NASA and NOAA, the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration, have each released their independent global temperature analysis for 2021. Both reports indicate that the past year continues a planet-warming trend that has made the last 8 years the warmest since records were first kept in 1880. While not as warm as the previous 2 years, 2021 was still tied with 2018 as the sixth highest temperature on record. According to the two reports, the global temperature for the past year was 0.84 degrees Celsius higher than the 20th century average and about 1.1 degrees Celsius above the late 19th century. The previous NASA analysis for 2020 showed that the temperature increase tied with the record high set in 2016. I'm VOA's Rick Pantaleo.
Hey, sports fans, brighten your day by tuning in to the sunny side of sports Monday through Friday at 1630 and 1830 UTC. Join us on Facebook at facebook.com/VOA Sunny and on Twitter at VOA Sunny Sports. Or check out the blog at blogs.voanews.com/sunny. It's the sunny side of sports right here on the Voice of America.
This has been International Edition on the Voice of America. On behalf of the entire production team, thank you so much for listening. Visit our website for in-depth coverage of world events and news 24 hours a day at voanews.com. Until next time, I am Chinedu Afo in Washington, wishing you a great day.
Of America, Washington, bye-bye.